The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Ask an Atheist, a weekly educational call-in program about atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. I'm Beth Lehman, and my co-hosts this week are Bob Seidensticker and Casey Doran. How are you doing, you guys?
Great.
Good, Beth. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. As with every beginning of the show for the last while now, we're going to start with a countdown to backpedaling. Looks like it's 83 days.
Oh, yeah, that's incredible. Well, Jesus is going to come back in 83 days. Everyone look busy.
Family Radio is the group that's putting it on,
yeah. And they have a website called We Can Know, meaning we can know when Jesus comes back, and we have a counter website that is wecantknow.com that tells you all about how we can't know that Jesus is going to be coming on May 21st 2011. Is that what
May
it is?
21st.
So, Bob, you had some special insight into why they chose that date over any other date, right?
I did. Apparently, Harold Camping is an engineer, and so he's got an interest in mathematics. And he decided that the day that Jesus was killed, I think it was April 1st in the year 30, the number of days between that and May 21st is 700,000 and something, some number. But here's the interesting thing. That number factors into 5 times 10 times 17, if I remember correctly, squared. Now, if you look at the science, I'm not talking about speculation, the science of numerology, you know that 5 is the number of something and 10 is the number of something else and 70 is the number of something else.
Sure.
But here's the important thing. It's squared.
Oh.
So it is like all that cool stuff just squared, and that is why May 21st is definitely it. Another thing which is kind of interesting is the number of days between that and the real end of the world. I don't know if this is what the point is, but apparently 153 days, that's the number of fish that Jesus helped them pull up at one point. Like, wow. why that number? What I have heard is that 153 is also interesting because it is 1 cubed plus 5 cubed plus 3 cubed equals 153. So a number like that works that way has to be true.
So it sort of reminds me of those email chain letters that you would get that says, pick any number between 1 and 10, now multiply it by 6, now divide it by 7. Oh, and your number is 13.
And it tells you correctly what it is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, it's absolutely fantastic how this is, if you follow Illuminati and Discordian lore, there's something called the Law of Fives, and it's just a numerical obsession. You can derive any number as a multiple of 5, add or subtract from 5. It's just the sort of thing with numerology is you can find any pattern you want to in numbers. So, but I mean, I guess it's great that it's squared. I think that maybe that makes it more profound, I suppose.
Now squared. We know that 2 is the Jesus exponent.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh. So let's go ahead. Yeah. Oh, man. So we're going to go ahead and go into listener emails. We've gotten a couple of good ones. The first one we're going to look at is from Kofi from Seattle. Kofi wrote us, and he basically had an observation. He's been watching the atheist community for quite some time, and he says back in the early 90s, it seemed that the internet was full of anti-God, dogmatic, religion-hating atheists and was a bit crazy. And he makes the observation that nowadays they seem to be very smart, sane, and nice folks who don't have any religion. How did things get better, or am I just better at finding good people? That's a really interesting question. Yeah, Casey, did you have a comment?
No, I mean, I think when I first read that, I was thinking, well, what is it about the early 90s that makes it full of such crazy dogmatic atheists? I don't know. Bill Clinton, perhaps, or we were discussing earlier, maybe it was Seinfeld? I don't know.
The brozier is definitely part of this.
I suppose now with the internet and what have you, there are more ways for you to actually hear about people who are real atheists and not the kind of atheists that would be on Fox News, you know, the kind that are the real fire and brimstone atheists, if I can mix metaphors. Now you can, if you want a level-headed opinion, you can find it. But I don't know what he's referring to specifically.
Well, and I think that one of the issues that we had talked about was the Out campaign, which is relatively, what year did the Out campaign start? Does anybody know offhand?
Just a couple of years ago, I think.
Yeah.
But that was certainly an outgrowth of the New Atheist's success.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And so my off-the-cuff theory that has absolutely no scientific merit whatsoever would
hypothesis.
Be, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that correction. Would be that in the early 90s, if you were looking for people who were the voice of atheism, it might stand to reason that what you would hear would be the most extreme of those voices because the Out campaign wasn't in full swing at that point, and so a lot of people didn't feel comfortable being openly atheist. So people who did may have had more extreme views. That's
I don't know. And if you've ever been to, like, a Green Party meeting or something, you realize that along some ways, some people like to go and meet with people that they can identify as like them. But a lot of people go just because they want to hear themselves, want to speak in front of other people and listen to themselves talk. And that usually ends up being the craziest, most irrational people. So I can understand how in that world when pre-internet, and the only way you know stuff is if someone happens to be a guest on Larry King or if you happen to go down to your local community hall on the right, you know, the right weekday night and hear some guy talking about Obama being a lizard person from outer space, you would have a
Cylon.
Pretty skewed view. Yeah, he's a Cylon.
Yeah, the right-hand man of the space pope.
Now it's really easy for us to, at any day, at any time of the day, go on and the internet and find scrolls about Obama being a lizard, reptiloid, chameleon shapeshifter.
And that's all true, by the way.
True story.
We also have another email. Let's go ahead and move on to Max. Max wrote an email, and his email, it's one of those things, it's a question that we get a lot, and it's a question that every time I hear it, I get a little bit more annoyed.
Well, the question is, where do atheists get their morals? And, you know, I'm pretty sure we've done shows on this just to death. I'm sure we have. But my short answer is the same place everyone else does.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Most people are going to say, who are we Christians, and say, oh, I get it from the reading the scripture and whatnot. Well, you grew up in a different place in the world, different parents. Your parents subscribe to different ideologies. But for the most part, we have law. We have things in our culture that we're agreed upon. So we get it from the world around us, our society, and partly our inborn sense of compassion and empathy with other people. So people are going to have different moral values than others. That's just the difference between people's personalities and upbringings.
The difference, I think, is the explanation, not where we actually get them.
Yeah,
that's a good point. That my answer would be pretty much similar to Casey's,
right?
Which is basically, I believe that I acquired my morals from my parents and from the general culture from which I was produced.
Mm-hmm.
So I might have moral opinions that reflect more of Maple Valley, Washington, the small rural town that I came from, versus, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, or something like that. And those discrepancies can certainly be traced, at least in part, to the cultural climate from the place where you're from. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that bothers me about that question is that in order to ask that question, it sort of insinuates that a potential answer is that we don't have morals. And assuming that someone doesn't have morals, another human being that you interact with, that to me is pretty insulting. It's a pretty insulting insinuation. I don't know if that's what Max was kind of going for.
Right. Well, if Max wants to rebut here, and if anyone else does on this particular topic, you can very easily find us on the internet at www.askanatheist.tv. And there's a giant Ask Your Question button on the website on the left-hand side, I think.
Yeah, giant red button.
A shiny red candy-like button for you to click on and type in your answer. And, you know, we try to respond to most of the emails we get. And if they're ones we like or apropos, we'll read them on the show.
Yeah, definitely. And if you have emailed us a question and we haven't responded to it, there's several different reasons for that. For one, and I'll be told...
We hate you. No, that's not it. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
You're not supposed to say it on air. One of the reasons might be that we are very busy. All of us that do this show, we're all volunteers. We all work on it in our spare time. So that might be the case. But it's also entirely possible that we have your email and we're holding on to it for a specific show. Like Max's email, for instance... We're planning on doing a show that focuses on morality and atheism. And so we touched on it today, but questions like that we receive, If you've sent us a question and you feel like we're ignoring you or you feel like we haven't addressed it properly, you can keep sending us the question. It could be that we're simply busy and it was overlooked. However, there's also the possibility that we're saving your question to respond to it in a different setting.
Sure.
So just keep that in mind when you're...
And if I can remind our listeners, this is Ask an Atheist on KLAY 1180. I just want to say, as an aside, totally off the script, that I listened to the show for the first time in the car driving up last weekend and you were hosting. Beth, you've got a great radio voice.
Thank you.
And Bob, you've got a face for radio. No, I'm joking. No.
That hurts.
You're a perfectly, perfectly handsome man, Bob. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. We are very lucky to actually have Bob here. We're not going to go into the topic full-blown right now, but I'll go ahead and introduce it just so we can get the introductory bit out of the way. The topic that we're focusing on today is apologetics, and this is a topic that I find very interesting because I don't know that much about it. I was raised in the sort of family that was, for all intents and purposes, secular. My father was an atheist, and my mom was actually excommunicated from the Catholic Church, but she's definitely a hardcore agnostic. So I don't know that much about scripture, and I'm completely honest with that when I have conversations with people who are religious, and I do hear the old, well, you don't know what you're talking about, so why do you have an opinion on this, which is a little annoying.
For fundamentalist Christians, not having read the scripture was never an impediment for them having an opinion. So it's not a, you should read it.
Definitely. Yeah. No, I should. So this is one topic that I find extremely interesting, and we're really lucky to have Bob here because Bob is a local author who has written a manuscript focused on apologetics. Among other things, he's also written other books. He is planning on attending a school in France or an academy.
How about that? That's pretty weird. There's a 2-week apologetic school in France, and this is for Christians to go and learn how to be a better apologeticist. It's going to be very strange. I listened to the founder of this thing on a podcast, and he seemed like a pretty reasonable guy. He was making a very strong statement in favor of separation of church and state, so that this guy can't be half bad. That's pretty cool. And I emailed and said, look, I'm an atheist. I find your academy interesting. Can I come? And they said, sure, but you probably won't be an atheist by the time we're done with you. I like a challenge, so we'll see what happens. But that's going to be in July. So maybe I'll come back on the show and tell you what happens.
You'll have to give us a report, because what if you do come back and you're converted?
Yes.
What does that mean for our lives?
I'll come back here with an agenda, yeah.
That's definitely. And one of the things that we want to reiterate throughout this show today is that Bob is definitely open. One of the reasons why I respect Bob so much is that he is not looking to have a combative argument. He's actually looking to increase the level of truth that he understands about life. And so when he has these conversations with people, he's not looking for a you against me sort of conversation. So if you have any sort of comments or complaints with what Bob brings up during the show, please, by all means, probably the best way to do it would be to go to our website, askanatheist.tv, and hit that shiny red button and send him a feedback. And we'll definitely make sure that he gets that. And if there's enough of a response from people on the show, I think that we can go ahead and do another one and sort of get more in depth into the topic. Because one of the things that we immediately notice when we address this topic was that there is a lot of information going into this. There's pages and pages of notes that go into explaining exactly what apologetics are and how to address them as an atheist. So
maybe I should just start off with just a definition of what apologetics is.
Yeah, definitely.
It comes from the Greek word apologia, which means defense. So if you were in court and it was your turn to defend yourself, you'd be giving an apologia. So apologetics doesn't mean apology. I think the words have the same root, but that's not at all what you're doing with apologetics. You're trying to give an intellectual defense, in this case, for Christianity.
That's interesting.
and actually, if I could, Beth, if I could just add on to one of the points you raised,
sure.
One thing which annoys me quite a bit about some of the Christian approaches to apologetics is they say it's sort of a cookbook approach. When the atheist says this, you need to respond with that. That is, they come with a preconception, and here's how to defend it. Here's how to make sure that no one pushes you off your preconception. And my approach is that is you know, ridiculous. That is not the way a truth seeker works. My feeling is let's make this a title match. If you prove to me that atheism is wrong, well, great. Then thank you for that. And let me you know find the correct way. So I'm definitely not trying to make arguments. Given that we're all atheists, we need to respond this way. Here is the other side of the issue, is all I'm saying. And if the Christian side is better, then that's the side that I want to go toward.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of whosever explanation makes more sense is going to win.
Let's just follow the facts.
I don't have a horse in this race.
Right.
No, that definitely makes sense. And I know that you're going to France, and that's really exciting. Do you have anything that's happening locally that people around here could?
I do. There's a Seattle Atheist has a lecture series. We meet once a month. I'm going to be speaking on March 20th on this topic, on apologetics. So if this is interesting, come and let's chat live. The website is seattleatheists.org for more information.
Definitely. And how long are those, or when they do those sort of chats, those lectures, how long does it usually go? How much time do they give you?
I think it's roughly an hour for the lecture, plus a little prep beforehand and conversation afterwards.
And there's always a question and answer period.
Absolutely.
That's
the most interesting.
So yeah. That would be, yeah, if you're interested in it, that would be the place. If you can't get on here, and again, if you want to give us a call and ask us a question on air, that would be great. The phone number is 253-584-1480, or go to the website. But if you want to ask Bob a question in person, definitely hit up that Seattle Atheists meeting.
Well, you and I are going to be alums of lecturers.
Yeah, you did a lecture as well. But right now, we're going to go ahead and head off to a break. We'll be right back with Bob Seidensticker, and the topic is apologetics. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. I'm here today with Bob Seidensticker and Casey Doran.
How's it going, Beth?
It's going pretty good. How are you guys feeling?
Great. Good.
Good. We're talking about apologetics, and Bob had just sort of explained what apologetics is. Let's see. When you are faced with an apologetics argument, because that's a situation that I found myself in, and I find it at times laughable, and at other times, really aggravating, because I'm not sure how I should respond. What is your suggestion for dealing with the situation where somebody springs one of these on you?
Yeah, there are a couple of general ideas, general principles that it helps to follow. And I'll touch on a few now, and maybe as we get into some of the specific arguments, we can talk about some of these in more detail.
Sure.
One thing to watch out for is the difference between "it's possible that" and "the evidence leads to." So very often they'll say, well, it's possible that God exists. You know, you can't deny that, and so on and so on. I grant that. You don't even have to argue that. I grant that God's possible. Let's move on beyond that. What I want to know is, where does the evidence point to? What is the most logical place the evidence points to? So they seem to be confused on that. One other difference to look out for is the difference between who created the universe and instead of what created the universe. Trying to slip in the idea that it was a person of some sort, as opposed to, well, let's not rule out physics. And one other idea that is really important to understand is the idea of burden of proof. And the idea there is, if you think about the analogy of a courtroom, the prosecution has the burden of proof. So if you imagine a judge in a courtroom, the prosecution gets up to make a statement, and it's just gibberish, and the defense gets up to make a statement. He says, "I like chocolate," and it just means nothing. There is no tie. The judge doesn't say, "Well, you both did a terrible job. It's a tie." There is no tie. The prosecution had the burden of proof. He failed to deliver on that, so therefore he loses. That's the way that works. And then if you think about how that applies to apologetics, if you are saying God exists, okay, fine, you have the burden of proof. In the same way that if I said I have a unicorn, I have had the burden of proof. If I do not meet that burden of proof, you are quite entitled. In fact, you are obliged to assume that I do not have enough evidence.
Well, Bob, what about if a potential hypothetical apologist were to say to you, you're saying that God doesn't exist, thus, you have the burden of proof to prove that he doesn't.
That's a great point. And that, I guess, gets back to the definition of the word atheist. My definition is simply someone who doesn't have a God belief. And I kind of prefer it that way, because that in my mind, puts the burden squarely on the Christian if he wants to say that God exists. Now, I can take on the burden of proof. I can say, well, let me just have a go at trying to prove to you that the best approach is to assume that God doesn't exist. But let's just make a distinction. I can certainly do that, but I'm not obliged to. So if there's a third party who listens to us haggle back and forth, if he thinks it's a draw or he is not convinced, he needs to conclude that the evidence points toward there not being God.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then I have actually a question myself, and you might be touching on this later in your notes. When it comes to apologetics and these sort of arguments, is it a willful? Is it willfully done to where people are trying to trip people up with things like slipping in who created the universe versus what created the universe? Are those well thought out moves, or is that just sort of a general error that people make, and you can sort of assume that it's an honest mistake?
That's a great question, and what I would prefer to do is to assume that it's simple ignorance or ineptitude, perhaps, on the part of the person, as opposed to maliciousness. When it comes to someone who's a professional, and he's been told this, someone like Ray Comfort, who's been corrected over and over and over again about these things, he's just being willful. I mean, he knows the correct science, and he could use it if he wants to. I obviously have no respect for that. But in the case of someone who comes at you with some sort of kind of nutty, kind of crazy argument, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that he is not trying to play some sort of trick or a debating technique on you.
Well, it makes sense, because you're essentially saying that you should employ the golden rule. You treat someone the way that you would want to be treated.
That's a charitable interpretation of his argument.
Yeah, right, definitely. Right. And if anyone else has a question for Bob, the phone number here is 253-584-1480. Please give us a call, and you can pick his ear on anything. What other arguments do you see that you would suggest people try to avoid? Is there anything else?
Well, just in terms of general principles, there's one observation. This comes from software. Stated in software terms, the admonition is that a program can be either so simple that it obviously has no errors, or it can be so complicated that it has no obvious errors. And that is often applied in arguments, in apologetics arguments, where a good argument is real simple, it makes sense, it fits together, it doesn't make your brain hurt. But then very often apologists will give you an argument you've never heard of before. Where does consciousness come from? What was the first cause? Where does logic come from? What grounds logic? You know, why does 1 plus 1 equals 2? At the foundations, these kind of things, the ontological arguments, some of these are just, really, really esoteric. And they win to some extent because the argument is confusing. Not because it's correct, not because it convinces you, but because it's confusing. And that doesn't mean, of course, that the argument is flawed. It just means that that's a little bit of dirty pool in my mind to beat you just because you haven't prepared for that argument.
Definitely, and I've had that experience myself, where I've been in a conversation with someone and have been just so confused by the information that they're giving me that I've sort of had to walk away and think, well, maybe I'm really not that educated on this topic. Maybe I really need to look into it. And then I look into it and I realize that I've just been given the runaround. And it's a bit frustrating, but like you said, employment of the golden rule is probably the best way to deal with that.
I think there's a difference between rhetorical tricks and reasoned argument, right? And that's the thing to stand up here. And maybe sometimes it's actually not so clear to you if you haven't heard it before. Not so clear to know if it was it's just someone actually trying to use a turn of phrase or use a confusion to try to throw you off from taking your argument. And I think the difference there is honesty. I mean, you use the idea about being the golden rule. Whenever I talk about any of this stuff, I always think the best, the maxim that I take is put yourself in this situation. If you ask me a question and I don't know the answer, what's more intellectually honest for me, to make something up or to say I don't know?
Exactly. There you go.
So if you find yourself in a conversation and you do the former, make something up, then you're not being honest. And having a conversation that's not honest is a conversation not worth having. And so I hope that just as a general sort of subject, apologetics isn't based purely on a dishonest premise.
Yeah, definitely.
But But anything that's basically, it's a defense more than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. It's a defense of a certain ideology.
Should we get into some of the specific
arguments? Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of defense, what are, like, for instance, the biblical arguments for Christianity, what are the sort of defenses that they put up?
Yeah, one of the most popular ones is the resurrection story. They look at the resurrection story and they say, okay, let's just look at the things that almost everybody accepts. Jesus was crucified, he died, he was in a tomb, there was an empty tomb afterwards, et cetera, et cetera. How do you explain that? And the just a great response that I heard from somebody was, of course the Land of Oz and the Emerald City exists. Where else would the Yellow Brick Road go to? I mean, come on, think about it. And of course, the flaw in that is to accept the tornado, the house, the Wicked Witch of the East, the Ruby Slippers, the Munchkins, and Glinda as fact. Let's just take that as fact. Well, okay, that's a good argument, but who takes that as fact? Come on, it's a story. And that's the same situation you have right here, where if you think of the story up to the resurrection, it's, you know, prove to me that's actual history, it's actual journalism. Then we have something to talk about. Until that point, it's a story.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. I think one of the ways that I end up looking at it, and I think the I think you might have mentioned this in your notes, but to look at the resurrection story or just the life of Jesus as a purported event in history, a purported actual thing that happened, Jesus being an actual person is, we don't really have any evidence other than the Bibles themselves, which were written by acolytes and followers of that particular religious tradition. So we have no evidence other than that to believe that anything in the Bible actually took place. Other than some things that we can corroborate with archaeology, but not much is left over, you know, 2,000 years in the future. The part that hinges is, yeah, maybe it's not so much of a stretch to say that Jesus Christ, a guy named Jesus Christ, lived 2,000 years ago. But the part that it hinges on is, and I think Christians would say, without the resurrection, there's not Christianity, right? Because Jesus' whole idea is that you can live again, and him. Being a man that has died and resurrected is central to that, but that is simply at the point where it's hard to take as history, as actual history, because how many of us have ever actually seen a person dead for 3 days and then suddenly get up like a zombie and walk? I ask you.
One other argument that people often make is, why would they die for a lie? This is the the naysayer argument, the idea that the disciples were all martyred for this. The problem with that, of course, is number one, the idea that the apostles were martyred is far after the Gospels. The Gospels were written 40, 60 years after the actual events they talk about. The ideas that the apostles were martyred, except for, I think, one, it's not in the New Testament. These are written, you know, decades after that. So number one, the stories are fluffy, very, very tangential. The other issue, which is perhaps more important, is what kind of a crime are we imagining where you could say, okay, just kidding, Jesus was just a myth, and they would let you go? If it was sedition, if it was rabble-rousing, if it was disturbing the peace, you can't, you know, if you're guilty, you're guilty. You can't say, you know, okay, I'm sorry, Jesus was a myth. That undercuts the idea that, of course, the disciples were telling the truth, because who would die for a lie? Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. I've always had a lot of issues with that particular argument. And if you have any issues that you want to talk about, please don't hesitate to give us a call. The phone number here is 253-584-1480. Or if you're a little radio shy, which a lot of us are, you can get a hold of us on our website, askanatheist.tv, and there's going to be a big red button that says Ask a Question. So in continuing...
Yes, how about the argument from design? Now, we talked, there are actually quite a few more Bible arguments from Christianity. What's surprising about a lot of the apologetics arguments is the two that I just gave you actually are Christian arguments, why you should believe the Christian story. But so many are what are called deist arguments. That is, if you were convinced by this, you'd say, okay, I'm on board. Now, who is the God we're talking about here? Is it are we talking about Shiva? Are we talking about Brahma? Are we talking about Quetzalcoatl? Is it Yahweh? Mm-hmm. It often seems to be a two-step process where they kind of soften you up with some of these deist arguments, and then they say, and now let's take step two. let's talk about why Yahweh, that is the God, the Christian God, is the actual God we're talking about. Why is it always a two-step process? Why do we, for something which is, we're talking about the most amazing thing ever, the you know, that Yahweh created everything. I mean, you know, if you think that the sun is obvious, he should be even more obvious. Why not just make it one step? Look, go look at this or do this. There you go. There's Yahweh. It's obvious.
Yeah, the complication of it seems, it's really confusing to me as someone who is pretty open-minded about these different ideas. I know that I identify as an atheist, but I've always sort of almost wanted to find some sort of logic in it, because I see so many people who are very devoutly religious, and it makes me upset to think that they could be so wrong. But then when I encounter apologist arguments, it's especially the arguments that have to do with science that really aggravate me, and that's probably because of my background. I'm a student in biological anthropology, and so I know, you know, a little bit as an early on student about this sort of information, and it's the science arguments that bother me. And I always have to wonder, why do Christians feel that they need to make sort of sciencey sounding arguments in this case? Is it because they feel threatened, or is it because they just want to have a response when someone says, well, what about this?
Well, there is as we know, living in the 21st century, beyond the 20th century, where we had the dawn of the age of science, science is, or at least to claim that there is scientific evidence behind something, is to give it a level of truth and veracity above just someone's opinion. And that's why, you know, we've done shows about skepticism, about, like, magnetic bracelets, you know, like the things that don't actually do anything, but they are told that they do something, and they'll say it's scientifically proven, and they'll want to use the word science because just the very notion of the fact that there has been an authority using science, the process of science, to back up this claim, gives it sort of more legs, even if it really is nothing other than an assertion. So that answers your question, why. Now, whether they do it honestly, probably not, because if you talk to someone who is, say, I don't know, a physicist or an astrophysicist, they'll tell you, well, I don't know if God created the universe, but I can tell you things of what happened when the universe was very, very young. And, you know, there are a lot of things we do know, and science gives it an authority. So that is a partial explanation. But I have to ask you, Bob, here, as I'll play the intelligent design advocate here, which is, have you ever seen a bee up close, Bob? That's complex. That's very complex. So it must have been designed intelligently.
there we go. And
isn't that a great argument?
Well, that of course is the confusion of complexity and design. And just because,
but it's complex.
It is complex. Okay, I grant you that. But that of course doesn't mean that it's designed. And that's a common fallacy. In fact, the general argument from design very often goes, it goes from a complexity standpoint, but also goes from takes off from a standpoint of beauty. Sunset babies, the cycles of nature.
Sure.
This is just a beautiful world we live in. And again, as you mentioned, it is indeed quite complex. At the same time, you could sort of take a contrarian approach, and you could say, well, yeah, there's sunsets and babies and that sort of thing. There's also malaria, tsunamis, and cancer. Did the same loving designer give us these? And you know, why is that? I mean, clearly he's just tossing stuff out there as opposed to giving us nothing but good things. There are a lot of arguments against the argument from design. Issues about the human body, the appendix, the tailbone. There's something called the laryngeal nerve, recurrent laryngeal nerve, I think it's called. It goes from the brain to the larynx by way of the heart.
Yes.
And that's because...
Very indirect route.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, from the brain to the larynx, to whatever became the larynx in a fish, straight shot. But then you have this neck that grows in a giraffe. This is including, this is all mammals. It makes a 7 foot times two detour. So you have these undesigned, apparently, or these poorly designed things. But if you look at genetics at DNA, which is often cited by apologists as, you know, sort of slam dunk evidence for a creator God, a designer God, you've got things like the vitamin C pseudogene in every one of our genes. We have the ability to make vitamin C, which is turned off. makes no sense at all.
That is really, I'm getting sucked into this conversation.
Mind blown.
We do have to go to a break, so please stay with us, and we'll be right back with Bob and a bit more of apologetics. Thank you. Hello, and welcome back. You are listening to Ask an Atheist. Today we have Bob Seidensticker and Casey Doran. We're having a conversation about apologetics, and I just want to take a really quick break to sort of apologize to Sam. Last week he called in, and he was snowed in South Dakota. He was supposed to come in today. He was actually supposed to host. But we were so excited to hear his lovely voice on the radio that we forgot to wish him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Sam.
So happy birthday. Yeah, happy birthday, Sam. And then also, since I'm already doing this, I wanted to say a quick hello to my son, Tristan, who is listening and is very excited that my voice is coming out of the radio machine.
Is his birthday today, too?
We can pretend like it is.
Sure. Happy birthday, Tristan.
Yay. Tristan is the best. Anyway, so we were having a conversation about apologetics, and we were sort of talking about these science-y arguments. Are there any other arguments that you notice come up on sort of a regular basis, or
there are one of the most popular ones is Pascal's wager, and this was popularized by Blaise Pascal hundreds of years ago. The basic idea is that it's simply a wise bet to bet with God. If you go ahead and act like a Christian and you win, and God is correct, think of this again as a bet, then you get heaven and so on and so on. If you don't do that and you lose, you go to hell, which would really be a bad thing. So don't do that. The problem, of course, is that the one response is you can't choose to believe. I mean, even if you could choose to believe, isn't God, who I hear is a pretty smart guy, going to see through that? You know, you just going through the motions to do this, but you
certainly can't make gravity not work by believing that it doesn't. Right?
Yeah, if you think you can choose to believe, come back next week and tell me that you believe in leprechauns now. It just doesn't work that way. But of course, the other thing is this applies to the Christian just as well. So if the Christian tells the atheist he needs to worry about getting on the wrong side with God, what about all the other gods? The Christian has bet against all them. Buddhist hell is not pretty. I've seen the pictures in the monasteries. You don't want to go there, and so on. So that's a surprisingly popular one, but I think only because people really haven't thought about it very much.
I've always said that if Pascal's wager gives a 50-50 argument for the Christian God existing, I want better odds than that.
Yeah.
50-50? It's got to be closer to more like 0.00 with like 10 repeating decimals, 1% that God actually exists. Right? 50-50?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
When I hear Pascal's wager, and I know that we did a whole show on this, so I don't want to dwell on it too long. But I think that my main reaction to that, when someone is honestly trying to put that forth as an argument, is that I wonder how much they respect their own belief. Because it seems to me that if you're the kind of religious
That's
person
true.
Who truly believes this, who truly believes in the truth of it and the beauty of it and, everything about it, why would you ever propose that argument? It's so flippant. It seems so. It seems to ignore all of the sort of earnest emotions that go along with religion, or are supposed to go along with religion.
And if you can imagine standing in front of God, if you've won with this argument, and He's going to say, "Okay, let me just get this straight. I gave you that big brain to just play games with me. I mean, there wasn't enough evidence, but you had to believe this way. I mean, come on, that's just not the way it's supposed to work."
Well, if you think Pascal's wager is an argument you can get on board with and you want to ask us about it, or any of these other arguments, again, the number to call here and talk to us, area code 253-584-1480.
Should we go on to another argument?
Yeah, definitely.
There's one we can just spend seconds on because it's just so ridiculous. This is what's often called the argument from preference. And that's the basic idea. Wouldn't you rather live life in paradise after death than nothing? And, I guess so, but how is that relevant? I mean,
I would rather be a millionaire right now, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
So that is just a confusion about, where, how wishes work. Do we live in Disney World? It's not even worth considering.
It's an interesting concept to me to think that reality works that way, to think that you can shape reality, and you can shape what is real basically because you want it enough.
Well, I mean,
the secret, the book, yeah, The Secret says you can.
This
so
is,
there.
This is dangerous because people like Deepak Chopra and a growing number of people are have this idea of manifesting, where somehow if they just imagine something with your brain, it can be so. But we all know, except for those of us that are clearly should be in an institution, we all know that you can stare down at the penny on the table and wish for it to, you know, to duplicate itself spontaneously into two pennies, that no matter how long we sat there, it wouldn't happen. It just doesn't happen. So the very fact that some people want to take this, I think The Secret was a little more nuanced. The Secret was sort of like, talk to people about the things that you want and try to learn more about how they get that way, and then you could reap the benefits by, you know, becoming more aware of what it is that you want.
Yeah, The Secret struck me as
move that beyond to being like wish fulfillment, to being literally just like you can make it reality by manifesting it with your mind. And I think people, even theists, know that in a non-religious concept is stupid, is foolhardy, you know.
Yeah, The Secret, I think the interesting thing about The Secret is that it's a little bit more covert. It goes under the radar because it's deepities, but it's sort of deepities that are dipped in a batter of therapy, sort of common sense therapy that we all know. If you talk about your problems, you're going to feel better about your problems.
With a rich nougat center.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's move on to another one. This is a C.S. Lewis argument. He was a great popularizer of some of these arguments. It's sort of the liar, I think of it as the liar, lunatic, lord argument. The basic idea is he says, well, let's look at the possibilities here. Jesus could be a liar, that is, he says, I'm God, but he really knows he's not. He could be a lunatic, he says, I am God, but he's just crazy. Or he could be saying, I am God, and that's really what he is. And yeah, I sort of, you know, again, scratch my head at this one, and I'm thinking, okay, is there yet a fourth possibility, maybe legend? Is that a possibility we need to think about here? Let me just tell you a quick story. There's the story of the Angel of Mons, M-O-N-S, if you want to look it up. If you remember the Disney movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks, at the very end, all the armor comes to life. That was inspired by this event. So what happened was there was a battle in the First World War, you know, just all kinds of just crazy, terrible battles in that war. The story got around. Somebody actually wrote a short story imagining that the British were given this, they were in desperate straits, and this army of angels came and saved them from the Germans. They fought on the British side and saved them from the Germans. And you can find the article. And this apparently was pulled into popular fiction. People actually thought that it really is what happened. I mean, I don't think the Bedknobs and Broomsticks author thought that way, but that actually was, you know, actually got sucked into it. We also know about urban legends, and we can analyze this. We can sort of go back and find the original email, how this morphed, this kind of thing. Did you know, by the way, that Augustus Caesar was born of a virgin? Did you know that he rose bodily into heaven and that a Roman senator saw this? So there's just all kinds of nutty stories, and the idea that Jesus was any different. The Jesus story is certainly impressive and amazing, but let's think about legend as William Tell or George Washington being invulnerable to British bullets might have been.
Well, and I think that's a common fallacy that a lot of people do, they become a victim of, which is basically the assumption that if something is old, then it has more credibility than things that are new.
Well, that's certainly the way it worked in antiquity, right? I mean, that's actually a fundamental difference between 21st century culture and first century BC culture, which is there had always been up until that point a reverence for stories, for beliefs, for traditions that are older, because there was the assumption that if it was old, it was inspired by our ancestors, it had more truth to it. Nowadays, actually, you know, when the Hubble Space Telescope looks further back into the sky and finds that we're actually a billion years older than we previously thought, we lend more weight to the newer evidence because we think, well, we're getting smarter, we're getting these things. So we've kind of inverted that. And so the idea that older truths are necessarily more preferable to new knowledge, I think, is a throwback at this point.
No, I would definitely agree with that.
We have stories of Gilgamesh, for example, from other cultures that are even older than the Old Testament. We don't give them much credence, so, you know, why do the same thing for this? If I could just add one more thing to this liar, lunatic, lord idea, the idea of the how the Gospels were written. They were put down on paper roughly 40 years and longer after the events. So you have 40 years of oral history for things like this. Oh, yeah, Augustus Caesar was born of a virgin. I did see him go to heaven, that kind of thing. For these kind of legends to happen, to add before it was written down on paper. And here's a thing which is often ignored. We see the Jesus story from Greek culture. The New Testament Gospels, all the New Testament books were written in Greek. It came from a Greek culture, and yet the Jesus story came from an Aramaic culture. So you have this enormous gulf from the illiterate peasants, the people, whatever they saw in around 30 CE, that had to be translated to a Greek culture to people who may not even have spoken Aramaic. So you have this enormous translation that you know, we talk about trying to get back to the original autographs of these books. We will never get back to the original stories because the best we can get back to is the Greek culture.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting because when I look into apologetics and the sort of arguments that are proposed, I see a lot of importance put on context. But when you delve into the issue and you see that it's a translated text, that it was oral history for almost half of a century, mm-hmm. I don't understand how the argument from context can really hold up. Because what context are you talking about? Are you talking about the original context? Are you talking about the translated context? Are you talking about the context of the, you know, influence of oral history on the story? It seems like a mistake for people who perpetuate apologetics to even bring up context, because it seems like it falls apart pretty fast once you actually look at the historical record.
Yeah.
Of
well,
the text.
I always look at it this way. consider, what is the title, King James Version of the Bible, what's the title in English that we give to Jesus? What's his title? Other than Christ, which is a title, but...
Son of God, Son of Man?
He's the Lord. The L word, he's the Lord. He's the Lord, he's your Lord, he's the Lord Jesus. If you were a 14th century peasant, what sort of geopolitical image in your mind of someone who's a Lord to you, what does that mean? He's your landlord, he's literally the guy who owns the land you work on. He probably has absolute control over life and death. He probably is born from a noble family, and so there's no possible way you could be a lord being a peasant. Think about the sociological connection in people's minds to have their savior, their divine savior, called a lord, and the guy who controls their lives called a lord. Just consider the context of just that very simple relation. What it ends up is you as the peasant have much more reverence for the noble guy who lives in the castle on the hill, because he's a lord just like Jesus is. He's a divine arbiter of your life, and he rules over you in a spiritual and physical sense.
Yeah, essentially a person in a position of influence that you have to respect.
I don't know what the Greek word for lord is. I don't know what it replaced, but I guarantee you the people in ancient Greece, in the ancient world, thought of that title and their own landlords in a totally separate way. And that's just one illustration of how our own perception of just the very words themselves are changed based on our context. And who knows how many thousands of places in it for English that may, you know,
sure.
that pivots on.
Actually, it's sort of an unrelated point, but that reminds me, when if you look at God, the words God and Lord in the Old Testament, those are translated from Yahweh, Elohim, various words, which are not really the same guy. If you go back to Levantine deities, those were Elohim and Yahweh were different people. So
wasn't Elohim a race of a race? There were many of them. Elohim is a plural.
In the same way that Olympus had many gods. Right.
Wow, that's really interesting. If you have anything to add to this conversation, we're getting almost to the end of our show, but we do have enough time to take a call if you are interested. The phone number is 253-584-1480, or if you want to go on our website, go to askanatheist.tv and just click on the big red button. You'll have a form to fill out to ask us a question. So, Bob, is there anything else that you want to hit on in the last couple minutes?
Sure. Let me talk about the accuracy of the Bible. That by itself is a pretty big issue.
Yeah, that's a pretty
big
one.
But I'll point.
Wait a minute.
I'll point listeners to just a couple of points. One is, what day was Jesus crucified on? And if you look at the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they say that he was killed on the day after Passover. That is, the Last Supper was the Passover meal, and then he was killed. In John, he was killed on the day of preparation. That is, the Last Supper was the day before the Passover meal. Mm-hmm. So just an absolute contradiction there. What some people have done to try to salvage the accuracy argument is that there were different calendars within Jewish culture at the time, which is true, but not in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, they just had one culture, and obviously these four books are all talking about just one small part of Jerusalem. So,
well, isn't the, as I heard it from studying the Synoptic Gospels in college, isn't actually the reason for that main discrepancy in John is that John was written for a Jewish audience, and they were intentionally trying to pivot on the concept of Jesus being the sacrificial lamb.
Exactly, so right.
There's a scriptural and theological reason for the change in that.
I would say a literary reason. I mean, right. it's actually from a literary standpoint, it's a beautiful idea that you have the unblemished lambs being killed on the day of preparation in the same way that Jesus, the unblemished lamb, was killed for God. Right. So that was the parallel there. But and I think that this is if you see it in the context that these four books were written, it's not really all that surprising. If you went back and you had a history or a journalistic approach to this, the original guys would say, you know, dude, what are you talking about? That is not what I wrote it for. I don't care whether I agreed with the other writers or not. They had their own point to make, and so did I. So they would just not see any this sort of historical contradiction. They wouldn't see it at all. That's not where they were coming from.
Right, and also realize that a sense of authoritative, an authoritative source, or there being an author as such, was a very foreign concept to ancient peoples, especially pre-literate cultures, because oral tradition means that you don't actually retell things literally the same way, not verbatim. The thrust of the story is carried on. So the fact there's literal consistency is kind of goes out the window because there was nothing authoritative.
The idea, my understanding is that the idea of actual absolute perfection in telling after telling is a concept that we invented after we have writing. In an oral culture, right. You know, if it changed and ebbed and flowed depending on the audience, that's totally cool. If I could just leave the listeners with just one little bit of homework, just for fun, look at the two places where the Ten Commandments are written. There's actually three places, but let's ignore the one in Deuteronomy. Moses came down the mountain with one set of tablets, and he got mad and he smashed it on the golden idol. That's Exodus 20. That's one set. He went back up and he got another set, and he came back down. That's Exodus 34. That's the funny set. Go read that one.
And I guess the thing that I think of when I think of inconsistencies in the Bible, and I'm not sure how many people have seen this, but didn't Sam Harris, his institute, actually create a visual for inconsistencies in the Bible that sort of looks like a big red rainbow?
That's insane.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've heard is that there are apologetics groups who are trying to actively explain every single one of those contradictions. So once that happens, that'll be interesting to hear about.
But keep in mind, that is rationalization. That is simply trying to salvage something with a preconception.
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Bob and Casey. This has been a great show. It's all the time we have for this week. Ask an Atheist is a production of NEDM Media. Our call screener today was Scott Leopold. Our co-hosts are Bob Seidensticker and Casey Doran.
Thank you.
I'm Beth Lehman.
Thank you.
Catch us online at AskAtheist.tv.
Keeping you informed, this is KLAY, Lakewood, Tacoma, your conversation.